replied, but I'm flexible. Malcolm's personal sincerity, uncompromising political integrity, and unapologetic love for black people the world over announced him as a global revolutionary. His human rights advocacy made him open to engagement with King's concept of radical black citizenship. Having surmised through experience that America's political system was run by imperialists who were also segregationists, Malcolm now made a distinction between structures of oppression and whites who gained privileges from living in an anti-black society. He now welcomed white support of human dignity for black people, so long as these new allies displayed enough political integrity to be just as active in your neighborhood as you have been in our neighborhood. Malcolm argued that racial justice required black political leadership to end racial oppression. This meant that even the most sympathetic whites could not define the scope of black citizenship. Malcolm's political thought remained animated by a deep interest in the impact of racial slavery on American society. He forcefully argued that, although slavery had ended, its power between and within black and white communities remained embedded in American democracy. After over a decade bleeding for a cause he now deemed misguided, Malcolm resisted the temptation to replace old political and religious dogmas with new ones. His interest in socialism, overtures to civil rights leaders, and receptiveness to white allies dovetailed with a larger goal of promoting black liberation by any means necessary. Malcolm preferred to think of his political evolution as the byproduct of an expanding perspective. "Travel broadens one's scope," he explained. "Any time you do any traveling, your scope will be broadened. It doesn't mean you change. You broaden." On Sunday, June 28th, Malcolm X officially announced the formation of the Organization of Afro-American Unity, OAAU. He addressed a group of 1,000 who listened to him read a mission statement that cited the U.S. Constitution and Declaration of Independence as documents, if put into practice, represent the essence of mankind's hopes and good intentions. The OAAU mixed revolutionary ambitions with a practical understanding of American democracy. It challenged the nation to reimagine civil rights struggles, arguing that protest, including appeals to the UN against the continued criminal justices blacks faced in America, required broad coalitions, grassroots organizing, and a deft understanding of the connections between local and international social movements fighting for human rights. Malcolm's opening remarks linked his new organization to Africa, a continent he praised for having achieved more independence, more recognition, more respect as human beings than you and I have. The OAAU proved to be more important as a template for the future than as an organizing force in the present. The group's call for community control of neighborhoods, black electoral power, and freedom from the shackles of white supremacy would stimulate a vitally important path for black political radicalism. Malcolm's call for a cultural revolution anticipated the coming birth of a black arts movement, whose themes of black beauty, pride, and literary self-determination shaped much of the next decade and beyond. Malcolm proposed to bequeath Promethean fire to all willing to join the OAAU for a modest yearly membership fee of $2. 2 days after the group's founding rally, Malcolm sprang into action. As if to make amends for all the years he spent ridiculing civil rights groups, he now offered his support, sending Martin Luther King Jr. a telegram in St. Augustine, Florida, which received no reply. Malcolm continued to engage in rhetorical combat during a visit to his birthplace of Omaha, Nebraska, where he addressed a local civil liberties group. In Omaha, Malcolm defined the struggle for racial equality as a national issue. "I consider anything south of Canada as the South," he quipped. "It's an American problem, and injustice in Mississippi or Alabama casts a reflection on Nebraska, New York, or Oregon." Smiling broadly and frequently during an hour-long press conference, Malcolm talked of peace but prepared for war. "Today," he argued, "the Ku Klux Klan has taken off its sheets and donned a uniform, a police uniform." Before he could defend nonviolent demonstrators in the South, Malcolm set out to save his own life by leaving New York City. Revelations of Elijah Muhammad's infidelities had electrified the black press, which documented claims that Muhammad brought Stork to six teens. Salacious details included secret abortions, unfair expulsions from the NOI, and a leader who claimed divinity but practiced bare-knuckle politics to keep a grip on a teetering empire. The Chicago Defender published an exposé featuring the messenger's prodigal son, Wallace Muhammad, and his apostate grandson, Hassan Sharif, who denounced Elijah Muhammad as a false prophet guilty of betraying the Muslim faithful. Chicago NOI officials traced the sordid maze of truthful allegations back to one source that needed to be silenced at all costs, Malcolm X. In the spring of 1964, Malcolm X offered a vision of revolution forged by his travels across the Third World, while Martin Luther King Jr. concentrated on domestic issues with an equal stake in shaping global affairs. Their meeting at the Senate building foreshadowed paths of political alignment between them. Malcolm's break from the NOI and 5-week tour of Africa and the Middle East expanded his political consciousness, even as it drew him closer to King's orbit. In many respects, Malcolm followed King throughout the first half of the year, a pattern that would continue as their political missions, seemingly worlds apart over the last decade, converged against domestic and international forces that still heralded King as a world historic prophet of peace and regarded Malcolm as the specter of violent revolt. Chapter 8. Seeking freedom like Dr. King, but faster. The occasion that drew Malcolm and Martin to the Senate proved to be a historic turning point. The Civil Rights Bill, H.R. 7152, consisted of legislation that banned discrimination in employment and dramatically increased federal power to end racial discrimination in public life and file suits on behalf of racially integrated schools. The bill was first proposed by President Kennedy, but evolved in the months after his assassination, aided through the legislative process by a coalition of liberal Democrats and Republicans in the Senate and House of Representatives, who bypassed a coalition of Dixiecrats and conservative Republicans, such as Arizona Senator Barry Goldwater, to pass the bill on July 2nd. The combined might of grassroots pressure from below and skillful legislative maneuvering from the Johnson administration above aligned the political stars to achieve the most expansive measure of racial justice since Reconstruction. King flew to Washington to attend President Johnson's signing of the Civil Rights Act, which passed 73-27 in the Senate and 289-126 in the House. King had come from St. Augustine, Florida, where the new law would go a long way toward ensuring a measure of racial integration, but would still require enforcement. Johnson addressed a group of 200 invited guests to the White House East Room, celebrating the victory while describing the current moment as a time of testing. King planned to continue what the president called an unending search for justice within our own borders by leading efforts to test out implementation of the new law, a situation that worried Johnson as the presidential election was just 4 months away. In private, King listened to the president, but in public, he went on the offensive, vowing to force compliance in recalcitrant southern cities and states. From the White House after the bill signing ceremony, King promised massive direct action programs targeting parts of the South unwilling to immediately desegregate in the face of sweeping new legislation. 1 month before the passage of the Civil Rights Bill, Malcolm X had given a surprising interview to novelist Robert Penn Warren at the Hotel Teresa, praising the goals of black dignity and respect. Compiled for a book, Who Speaks for the Negro, published to great fanfare the next year, and also featuring an interview with King, Malcolm's interview confounded Warren. Warren had reached for the cliched terms, racial separatism versus integration, nonviolence versus self-defense, that dominated the mainstream civil rights discussion. Malcolm refused to be boxed in by these binaries, which failed to recognize the full range of black political reality. He eschewed his past racial separatism as impractical, even as he decried conventional notions of racial integration as a fantasy. Self-determination offered the tools for the Black dignity and political power necessary to reshape American society. Malcolm suggested nonviolence with King is only a method, but far from his main objective. He now recognized King as a fellow traveler on a human rights mission that conventional liberals could hardly recognize. Well, his objective, I think, is to gain respect for Negroes as human beings, Malcolm told Warren, summoning a kind of patience that allowed for the slow unpeeling of hidden truth. Yes, affirmed Warren. And nonviolence is his method, said Malcolm. Well, my objective is the same as King's. If he had spoken these words on national television, it might well have been a bombshell that made international news. Disagreements over methods, Malcolm went on, did not preclude an alliance with King, as long as we agree that the thing that the Afro-American wants and needs is recognition and respect as a human being. By this time, Malcolm no longer viewed himself as at odds with King's goals, a point Warren could hardly fathom. Finding common ground in a mutual quest for radical Black dignity, Malcolm disparaged nonviolence but kept his eyes on the larger prize of Black citizenship. United Press International reporter Bryce B. Miller emerged as one of the few journalists of the era to comprehend this, noting in a story that summer that Malcolm X was seeking freedom like Dr. King, but faster. Malcolm's efforts on behalf of this goal included cultivating a relationship with Clarence Jones, the Black lawyer who doubled as one of King's closest confidants. Jones and a group of Black intellectuals met with Malcolm at the home of actor Sidney Poitier in New York that June to listen to him privately detail his plans to charge America with human rights violations before the United Nations. Whitney Young of the Urban League attended, as did writer John Oliver Killens and the well-known actors Ruby Dee and Ossie Davis. Jones concealed his attendance at this meeting to King, but nonetheless presented himself to Malcolm as an authorized surrogate, testing the waters for the potential of a more formal meeting between the two leaders in the near future. On June 30th, Malcolm fired off a telegram to King, who was spending increasing amounts of time in St. Augustine, spearheading a campaign to desegregate the nation's oldest city. Racial violence against demonstrators echoed aspects of Birmingham, yet this campaign produced none of the high drama of the Magic City, turning it into less of a watershed moment than a war of attrition, marked by local thugs beating African Americans trying to integrate segregated beaches. We have been witnessing with great concern the vicious attacks of the white racists against our poor defenseless people there in St. Augustine, began Malcolm's telegram. If the Johnson administration delayed in offering help, Malcolm noted, just say the word, and we will immediately dispatch some of our brothers there to organize self-defense unity among our people, and the Ku Klux Klan will then receive a taste of its own medicine, he continued. The day of turning the other cheek to those brute beasts is over. No doubt sincere in his offer, Malcolm's telegram received no reply from King. Nonetheless, it marked the continuation of Malcolm's efforts to cultivate a dialogue between the two that would continue throughout the year. The police shooting of a 15-year-old Black teenager from New York City drew King to Harlem as local protests swelled into a full-scale riot. Malcolm X's return to Africa at the end of June had left a temporary vacuum among Black militants eager to harness the community's outrage. King's reluctance to negotiate with Mayor Robert F. Wagner proved to be well-founded after four meetings produced no tangible concessions from City Hall. Demands for a civilian police review board were ignored, and Wagner placed King in the position of advocating an untenable middle ground between revolutionary calls from Harlem activists, such as rent strike leader Jesse Gray, and the anti-Black posture of Police Commissioner Michael Murphy, an old nemesis of Malcolm X. Characterizing Murphy as unresponsive to the demands or aspirations of Blacks, King caught a glimpse of the particular style of white power in New York that Malcolm had spent over a decade combating. Harlem pushed King to publicly demand more police accountability, a course of action that offered a prelude to his increasing political radicalism. The mayor had invited King to New York as a peacemaker, only to discover, to his chagrin, that the apostle of nonviolence remained most comfortable as a passionate truth-teller. Harlem exposed King to a deeper reality of institutional racism that made him better able to understand Malcolm X's political rage, as well as the intractable forces that remained obstacles to the revolutionary changes that true justice required. As King negotiated for peace in Harlem, Malcolm X was making diplomatic inroads in Africa. During the trip, he grappled with his political and religious identities. In correspondence with Islamic scholar Dr. Malik Badri of the American University of Beirut, he confessed the need to wear two hats to be an effective leader. As both a Muslim religious leader and an Afro-American freedom fighter, he addressed two at times overlapping audiences on the world stage. World leaders more easily recognized him as a black freedom fighter, a situation he was now seeking to rectify. For political and practical reasons, Malcolm hoped to gain official recognition as a legitimate Muslim leader, in contrast to the skepticism that still surrounded the Nation of Islam abroad and resources from the Islamic world, and, in the process, end confusion among Orthodox Muslims regarding his religious leadership back home. Malcolm was convinced that his Muslim identity offered the basis to build global coalitions, so he couched his political mission in religious terms while in Cairo, urging officials to support him on a quest to spread Islam throughout the West. Writing to the Supreme Council for Islamic Affairs, Malcolm positioned himself as a moderating influence between liberal and conservative forces in the Muslim world. "My heart is in Cairo," he explained, touting the city as home to the most progressive forces in the world. But Malcolm refused to completely submerge his racial identity into a religious one. His status as a social justice leader still outshone his emerging identity as an Orthodox Muslim minister with a modest group of devoted followers in the Muslim Mosque, Inc., some of whom still clung stubbornly to discredited tenets of the NOI. Indeed, Malcolm's status as a radical black political activist opened more diplomatic channels than his identity as a Muslim, although news of his successful Hajj found him embraced by Muslim diplomats, activists, and leaders during his travels. Malcolm sought to merge his political and religious identities by becoming a secular evangelist, one comfortable enough in his religious faith to proudly proclaim, "I am a Muslim," twice during a debate at Oxford University, and bold enough to argue that the key to eradicating American racism was a movement that recognized black people's inherent humanity. Malcolm had emerged from his conflict with Muhammad, local police and FBI surveillance, assassination attempts, and organizational setbacks to achieve a measure of grace that had eluded him since his years of confinement in a Massachusetts state prison. He survived the humiliating spectacle of having spent over a decade idolizing someone he now regarded as a false prophet. Now, Malcolm was seen as the embodiment of the struggle for black dignity in America and around the world. Malcolm set his sights on conquering new political worlds just as King confronted ghosts of racial prejudice back home. King's rising political stature lent an already hectic schedule of speeches, fundraisers, and meetings the air of a political campaign. The 1964 presidential election season often found him juggling divergent, at times contradictory roles as a political dissident, presidential ally, and national political mobilizer. King's July 7th appearance before the Republican Party's platform committee in San Francisco, where he warned against complacency in the civil rights struggle, represented a high-profile stop on a summer filled with speeches that took him from rural hamlets in Mississippi to the streets of Harlem. King's brief tour of Mississippi in July marked his first return to the Magnolia State since Medgar Evers' funeral. Protected by FBI agents reluctantly deployed by Director Hoover at the insistence of President Johnson, King resumed direct contact with SNCC activists who continued to mock, prod, and cajole him into more radical action. Although King fielded Malcolm X's radicalism from a distance, SNCC represented a more painfully intimate source of conflict. SNCC placed new pressure on King through the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, MFDP. The MFDP challenged to the state's all-white delegation set the stage for a historic confrontation at the Democratic National Convention in Atlantic City that August. MFDP delegates, led by sharecropper turned activist Fannie Lou Hamer, lobbied Democratic Party officials, civil rights leaders, and labor organizers for a literal seat at the political table. This required either acquiescence from state's Jim Crow political machine or their expulsion. Bayard Rustin supported the MFDP challenge, but his deep ties to big labor blunted his usual go-for-broke strategies, which elicited cries of betrayal from former Rustin disciples, most notably one young activist who screamed, "You're a traitor, Bayard, a traitor!" Following a speech that called for surrender under the guise of recognizing the difference between protest and politics, Hamer's televised address on Saturday, August 22nd, turned a formal credentials committee hearing into riveting political drama. She recounted 2 years of racial terror in Mississippi, including a savage beating in tiny Winona for trying to register to vote. "I didn't try to register for you," she told the plantation owner who had evicted her entire family after her initial registration attempt. "I tried to register for myself." Hamer's failure to register to vote inspired a torrent of political will that shone through her plain-spoken eloquence. Her exposure of the hidden blight in the recesses of American democracy was enough for Lyndon Johnson to launch an impromptu news conference expressly meant to interrupt her live testimony. Behind the scenes, Johnson threatened, bullied, and cajoled allies, surrogates, and his presumed running mate, Minnesota Senator Hubert Humphrey, into squashing the MFDP's efforts, which he interpreted as a threat to party unity and ultimate victory in November. Martin Luther King Jr. lobbied hard on behalf of the new party, even at the risk of damaging his relationship with the president. MFDP delegates recognized Johnson's offer of 2 non-voting delegates to the Democratic convention as an insult, even as Bayard Rustin and others advised taking the deal. The proposed compromise meant that the Democratic Party would officially recognize the segregated Mississippi Party members at the convention, while only allowing the integrated MFDP delegates to observe, but not vote, during the proceedings. Facing pressure from all sides, King confessed that the MFDP's acceptance of Johnson's offer would make his life easier. "But if I were a Mississippi Negro, I would vote against it." Which is exactly what the MFDP did, maintaining their political integrity in the face of small and large betrayals that span from United Auto Worker lawyers and political lobbyists all the way to the White House. The Atlantic City debacle cleaved one faction of SNCC activists away from the Democratic Party and mainstream politics and thrust others, most notably Fannie Lou Hamer, who would be a delegate 4 years later, deep into the party machinery. King departed the convention, having missed the Johnson and Humphrey acceptance speeches, in the face of withering private criticism from SNCC activists, who lumped him together with Rustin as supporting the rejected compromise. On Wednesday, October 14, 1964, Coretta called King with the news that he would be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. The news lifted King above the politics of Atlantic City and elevated his stature as a global figure. The decision to award the prize to King recognized nonviolence as a political philosophy capable of changing the world. The Nobel arrived at a critical moment for him, the youngest ever recipient of the award at 35. King dedicated the prize money and the attached symbolism to the movement.
"I am a minister of the gospel, not a political leader," he demurred.
In truth, he was both, which made him, weeks before presidential election, a rival to Johnson on the world stage. The president recognized as much. From Air Force One, he dictated a memo congratulating King 2 days after the announcement. Johnson noted the award's global implications. "It signals," he said, "the world's recognition that Americans committed to a course of justice for all our people and the role that you have played in that effort. The award is not only a tribute to you, but to the nation as well." The president's note sought to interpret the Nobel Prize as a symbol of racial progress and a peculiar kind of American exceptionalism that allowed even racially oppressed groups to garner the type of global reputation usually befitting monarchs and millionaires. King's international stature now compelled Johnson to treat him as less of an adversary, at least publicly, than a political equal. The Nobel Prize Committee's decision also acknowledged Malcolm X's insistence that racial justice was a global issue that Americans could no longer ignore. Newspapers regarded King's victory as internationalizing the civil rights movement. Black editorials stressed King's personal sacrifice in the face of racial violence, while the white press lauded him for helping to burnish America's global image of racial progress. King barnstormed around the country organizing black voter turnout as his staff prepared for his December trip to Oslo to accept the prize. He blasted Goldwaterism during a speech before the Baptist Ministers' Conference in Los Angeles, warning that the Republican Party's presidential nominee threatened the health, morality, and survival of our nation. He didn't mention his recent disappointment in Goldwater's challenger. After the election, King cited Johnson's landslide victory over Goldwater as a definite mandate for civil rights. Simultaneously, he promised to increase voting rights demonstrations in Mississippi and Alabama. King's plans to organize a massive voting rights campaign in the South dovetailed with his larger ambitions to mobilize national demonstrations that would turn political beachheads in the northern and western parts of the country into headquarters for racial and economic justice. In short, King proposed to mobilize a broad-based coalition in pursuit of an expansive vision of black radical citizenship, far beyond the political imagination of elected officials, to lift the most despised Americans from poverty, hunger, and racial segregation. The corollary to Johnson's electoral landslide could be seen in the coming 89th Congress, where Democrats controlled 295 of 435 seats in the House of Representatives and fell just 2 seats short of 70 in the 100-seat Senate. This Congress would pass much of Johnson's Great Society legislation, but for King, the ideal of the Great Society fell short of the scale of social change the nation required. Its historic passing set the stage for King's transformation into a political revolutionary whose critique of American democracy found him converging with Malcolm X. When they met in the Senate, Malcolm joked to King, "Now you're going to get investigated." The comment assumed that federal agents weren't already interested in King, but government and law enforcement officials kept track of both Malcolm and Martin. J. Edgar Hoover had called King the nation's most notorious liar and used King's connections to Stanley Levison as proof of his political bankruptcy. Hoover used evidence of King's extramarital affairs, gleaned through illegal wiretapping, to prove his moral degeneracy. King had a portfolio of surveillance all to himself, motivated by Hoover's personal enmity and sanctioned by Bobby Kennedy, the former attorney general now running for a New York State Senate seat. King's growing international reputation, culminating in the Nobel Prize and his campaign for the Democratic Party in the presidential election, spurred Hoover into action. The FBI director's boldest gambit would come early in the new year, in the form of an anonymous package authored by the FBI that threatened to reveal King's extramarital affairs. The package, initially opened by Coretta, urged King to commit suicide rather than risk public shame. King resisted the ploy, but remained anxious that his private life might prove fodder for public consumption, even as he looked ahead toward mounting a voting rights campaign in Selma, Alabama. While King's Nobel Prize helped coalesce world opinion around the importance of civil rights and racial justice, Malcolm X practiced his own brand of personal diplomacy in Africa. In London, he met with the aides of African leaders he planned to lobby in Cairo. Malcolm's ultimate objective of having African rulers charge the United States with human rights violations against black Americans at the United Nations relied on audacious hope. If our problem does not come up, then neither South Africa, nor Angola, nor Southern Rhodesia, nor any other colonial issue should be discussed at the United Nations, he defiantly informed reporters. In Cairo, Malcolm settled into the role as Black America's unofficial prime minister. He arrived in Africa brimming with confidence that he represented the majority of the black folk he characterized as field Negroes. In Africa, he planned to broker alliances, secure financial and organizational resources, and formalize broad-based Pan-African coalitions on behalf of 22 million black people, whom Malcolm recognized as political leverage in his plans to seek international allies in the struggle for radical black dignity. Granted permission to attend the Organization of African Unity Conference in Cairo, Malcolm made the case that African countries should support his fledgling group, the OAAU, even at the risk of angering American officials. The New York Journal American blasted Malcolm as a pawn in a bigger game orchestrated by communists, who relish the black radicals' provocative description of the United States as a national torture chamber on race matters. To reporters who questioned his appearance in Cairo, Malcolm answered succinctly, "I have as much right to be an observer from an oppressed area as they, white reporters, have." Once again underscoring how America's system of Jim Crow mirrored colonial regimes condemned the world over. He warned journalists that a bloodbath is on its way to America. Such provocations at times obscured Malcolm's more nuanced efforts to reveal the true plight of blacks in America to a global audience. The formal aid that Malcolm hoped for in Cairo would prove elusive, however, with Organization of African Unity leaders unwilling to risk a public break with America. Malcolm navigated murky political waters, where even Kwame Nkrumah, a leader he admired and thought made the best and most comprehensive speech in Cairo, spoke circumspectly on the subject of racial inequality. Malcolm chafed at listening to speeches where African heads of state seemed to avoid mentioning the U.S. and its racism. American State Department officials fretted over the consequences of Malcolm's freelance diplomacy, parsed through rumors that the Saudis were bankrolling him, and breathed a sigh of relief that no African countries were willing to publicly support the OAAU's explosive agenda. In his diary, Malcolm extolled the importance of building bridges of communication, understanding, and cooperation between Africans and Afro-Americans. This was the raison d'etre of his trip to Cairo, to use international diplomacy as a political sword capable of transforming the relationship between black Americans and the federal government by leveraging the power of Africa. The OAAU memorandum that Malcolm Hand delivered in Cairo offered a revised Pan-African narrative that suggested Africans, not black Americans, were in a unique position to aid their long-lost brothers and sisters. The memo rejected strains of black nationalism and Pan-Africanism, including aspects of Garveyism, that imagine Africa as a benighted continent awaiting rescue from black Western educated elites. It described U.S. racial politics in one sentence. "During the past 10 years, the entire world has witnessed our men, women, and children being attacked and bitten by vicious police dogs, brutally beaten by police clubs, and washed down the sewers by high-pressure water hoses that would rip the clothes from our bodies and the flesh from our limbs." America's racial crisis, far from being a local or domestic issue, was part of a larger global crisis. It is not a problem of civil rights, but a problem of human rights. Rather than condemn America to a violent catastrophe based in religious prophecy, as the NOI had done, Malcolm openly pleaded with African leaders for aid in forcing a UN investigation into human rights violations against black Americans. Ultimately, he failed in this goal, but on the trip he forged strong bonds with an influential coterie of African and Third World activists, intellectuals, grassroots leaders, and organizers. FBI agents, meanwhile, monitored Malcolm's international activities with keen interest. As Malcolm lobbied in Cairo, New York's special agent in charge forwarded Director Hoover a news story announcing Socialist Workers Party presidential candidate Clifton DeBerry's public endorsement of Malcolm's OAAU. The FBI also tracked down false rumors that Malcolm had already returned from Africa with plans to turn his earlier talk of rifle clubs into reality. At home and abroad, Malcolm attracted the attention of several law enforcement agencies, a level of scrutiny that would only, and perhaps surprisingly, be surpassed by that directed at Martin Luther King Jr. Malcolm's international foray cast him as a bridge between two generations of politically engaged black radicals. Langston Hughes, the poet laureate of the Harlem Renaissance who cut his teeth in anti-colonial politics, alongside the Abraham Lincoln Brigade of American volunteers resisting fascism in 1937 Spain, reminded Malcolm of this long history. Hughes belonged to a generation enthralled by the actor, singer, and activist Paul Robeson's legendary solidarity with political underdogs around the world. Robeson's global fame marked him for enduring infamy during the Cold War, his illegal passport revocation symbolizing America's silencing of dissident voices after the post-war freedom surge of the 1940s. Hughes, while applauding Malcolm's efforts in Cairo, recalled two earlier efforts by the National Negro Congress and the NAACP to gain UN support for black citizenship. Malcolm's call for a human rights movement also enthralled a younger generation captivated by African decolonization, thrilled by the sit-in movement, and angered by the sight of racial violence against civil rights demonstrators. SNCC Chairman John Lewis, only dimly aware of the long history of black radicalism, was influenced by Malcolm's electrifying African tour. "I respected Malcolm," Lewis recalled. He had already begun to sympathize with Malcolm's fervent anti-racist posture before encountering him personally in Kenya during Malcolm's visit. There, Malcolm told Lewis that he planned to tour the South after returning from Africa. Malcolm impressed upon Lewis that this was a world struggle we were engaged in here, not just an American struggle. Lewis went from viewing Malcolm as an outsider to preparing to meet him on the shared battleground of America's domestic civil rights struggle. And Malcolm now counted Lewis, one of the most devout believers in nonviolence next to King, as a political ally in expanding the black freedom struggle into a human rights movement capable of liberating America and Africa and beyond. For Malcolm, links between Harlem, Mississippi, and Africa were self-evident, yet obscured by self-defeating political interests on both sides of the Atlantic. But as he toured Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Lebanon, his face graced the cover of the Saturday Evening Post back home, which published excerpts from his forthcoming autobiography. Since 1963, Malcolm had been working with journalist Alex Haley on a memoir narrating his evolution from a criminal into a global freedom fighter. The political drama surrounding Malcolm's exit from the NOI made the book more newsworthy than ever. The Post touted Malcolm's own story of crime, conversion, and black Muslims in action to lure readers in. It framed Malcolm's prediction that more and worse riots will erupt as real-life urban pulp fiction. Although Malcolm had worked to craft a reputation as a leader wielding a political sword, image makers continued to rely on his notoriety as a selling point to American audiences. Ebony magazine published an insightful profile, Mystery of Malcolm X, that offered a tantalizingly nuanced portrait of Malcolm. Accompanied by 15 photographs, the story portrayed him as a man of startling juxtapositions, a political activist who once trafficked in anti-white prejudice, now insisting that whites are human beings as long as this is borne out by their humane treatment of Negroes. Driving around New York City in a dark navy sedan, dressed in a seersucker suit, dark frame glasses, and sporting a reddish blonde goatee, Malcolm captivated Harlemites, who gave him presents for his newborn daughter, and curious whites, who chatted with him like an old friend as he drove around town. A large poster of Kwame Nkrumah hung inside his East Elmhurst, Queens home, and photographs depicted Malcolm as a loving father, devoted husband, and fierce warrior who owned a rifle for protection. Malcolm's tireless work ethic found him taking on 15-hour days that tested his physical stamina, exacerbated by death threats that he openly discussed with anyone willing to listen. The story presented Malcolm as a man in the process of becoming a radical activist willing to admit that the NAACP is doing some good in one breath and accused nonviolent Negroes of needing psychiatric care in the next. Ebony's version of Malcolm X imbued him with a grounded humanity missing from many media portrayals. Malcolm leaped off the page, not so much as an icon, but as a three-dimensional black man, desperately trying, and at times failing, to lead a political revolution. In an American political and cultural milieu that solely acknowledged him as Martin Luther King Jr.'s violent foil, the profile daringly identified Malcolm as a radical humanist, one equally at home chatting with Harlem kids who greeted him with "Salam Aleikum, Brother Malcolm," and threatening to send armed guerrillas into Mississippi to protect civil rights workers. The main difference between himself and King, Malcolm told Ethiopian students in Addis Ababa during a lecture in early October, is that he doesn't mind being beaten up, and I do. Malcolm now identified himself as an activist, seeking the same goals as King, but who chose different methods to get there. However, Malcolm's sophisticated understanding of the growing areas of political convergence between himself and King remained largely ignored by the public. After over a decade of forcefully criticizing the civil rights movement, Malcolm now recognized King's ultimate goal of achieving black citizenship as his own cause. In Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, Malcolm regaled global journalists with vivid descriptions of American racism and efforts to make Africans hate American Negroes, a circumstance his presence on the continent helped upend. Malcolm attracted front-page attention in the local papers, The Nationalist and the Tanganyika Standard, characterizing the presidential race as a choice between the lesser of two evils. He vowed to return to America only after the election to prevent right-wing forces from exploiting his presence on behalf of Goldwater. Malcolm described Goldwater as a villain that suits the American psychology of avoiding the nation's tragic racial history. The African press cultivated Malcolm's image as perhaps the most important black freedom fighter of the era. In Monrovia, Liberia, Malcolm spoke about human rights during a lunch in his honor attended by a range of dignitaries. He applauded China's nuclear capability as a victory for the Third World, expressed skepticism over Lyndon Johnson's political sincerity toward blacks, and indicated mild disapproval of America's new Nobel Prize winner. "They should have given it to Lumumba, Nkrumah, Kenyatta, or Mandela," claimed Malcolm, offering a catalog of martyred, living, and imprisoned African leaders more deserving than King. His love for controversy remained. "I learned that white people only understand the language of hurt, pain, and blood," he reportedly said in Liberia. "If you speak any other language, you speak over their heads." Established heads of state accorded him respectful audiences, while more dissident oppositional leaders openly embraced his call for political liberation by any means necessary. Malcolm X spent the last week of his trip in Paris, speaking to a capacity crowd at the Maison de la Mutualité, where he displayed evidence of conquering old demons by speaking approvingly, "How can anyone be against love?" of interracial marriage. He also discussed the role of black Americans in the African Revolution. "In Africa, I met open hearts, open arms, and open spirits," he proudly asserted. He narrated his recent 19-week African sojourn as a family reunion that amplified his efforts in pursuit of global radical black dignity. Malcolm contrasted the potential good American power could accomplish in the world with the brutal reality that his nation was too morally bankrupt to help anybody, anywhere. No aspect of his remarks in Paris made waves in the American press, which seemed more eager to chronicle his continuing legal battle to avoid eviction from his Queens home than his international diplomacy. On November 24, 1964, Malcolm was greeted at Kennedy Airport by Betty, three of his daughters, and signs reading, "Welcome back, Brother Malcolm." He returned for less than a week before flying to Europe, a trip that would see one of the most important speeches of his life. He toured Manchester and Sheffield, England, rapidly deindustrializing cities brimming with long simmering class tensions and imminent racial anxieties. Malcolm's visit coincided with Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech at St. Paul's Cathedral in London, part of an international victory lap on his way to collect his Peace Prize in Oslo. In London, King described racism as a world problem, telling reporters that racial apartheid in South Africa merited an international boycott. Annoyed by what he may have interpreted as King's global recognition at the expense of his own foreign travels, Malcolm blasted King's nonviolent methods as bankrupt, noting that jailed South African anti-apartheid leader Nelson Mandela tried a similar strategy. Malcolm explained over London radio, "He, too, practiced nonviolence and discovered to his dismay that it just didn't work, and finally, Mandela resorted to violence." In a speech at Oxford Union, carried exclusively by the BBC, Malcolm called for a political revolution using the words of a man he had described as a villain and a wolf, recently defeated presidential candidate Barry Goldwater. Goldwater's controversial quote formed the basis of the debate topic. "Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. Moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue." Malcolm's performance captured the radical imagination of Oxford students, who jammed the hall, unsure of exactly what to expect. His 30-minute lecture spanned political, religious, historical, and intellectual worlds to sketch out the parameters of an unfolding revolution against colonialism, racism, and injustice. "I don't believe in any form of unjustified extremism. But when a man is exercising extremism in defense of liberty for human beings, I do not consider that a vice," Malcolm argued. "When a man is moderate in defense of justice for human beings, I say he is a sinner," he explained, publicly echoing aspects of King's critique of white liberals. Malcolm pleaded with the young generation of whites, blacks, browns present to organize on behalf of revolutionary change. He promised they would not be alone, declaring his willingness to join in with anyone. "I don't care what color you are, as long as you want to change this miserable condition on this earth." His final thank you triggered rapturous applause. 4 days later, Martin Luther King Jr. spoke at City Temple in London. King's discussion of the historical justification of racial slavery in America became an expansive talk about the evils of racial segregation compounded with economic injustice that included racism in labor unions and public policy. Black citizenship, King argued, would require massive retraining programs, massive public works programs to provide jobs, education, decent housing, and adequate health facilities. King repudiated critics who cited high rates of poverty and crime in black communities as the reason whites resisted racial integration.
"It is a torturous logic to use the tragic results of racial segregation," he observed, "as an argument for the continuation of it."
In London, King explicitly tied black citizenship to a wider search for economic justice, a theme he would amplify in coming years. Toward the end of his speech, he talked about the struggle to end racial apartheid in South Africa. He compared it to racial injustice in Mississippi and called Nelson Mandela a great leader, wrongfully imprisoned for demanding justice in an authoritarian police state. King advocated for economic sanctions against South Africa and publicly repudiated the United States and Britain for failing to more forcefully align themselves with anti-apartheid activists. The speech defined racism as a global problem and, like Malcolm X's new rallying cry, announced black citizenship as the crown jewel of an international movement for human rights. The next day, King, along with an entourage of family, colleagues, and friends, arrived in Oslo, Norway.
"We feel we have much to learn from Scandinavia's democratic socialist tradition, and from the manner in which you have overcome many of the social and economic problems that still plague a far more powerful and affluent nation," King remarked.
He accepted the Nobel Prize on Thursday, December 10th at Oslo University from King Olav V. He dressed formally in an ascot, gray tailcoat, and striped pants, and was introduced as an undaunted champion of peace. When King accepted the prize on behalf of the movement, he noted how improbable this day had seemed against the backdrop of Montgomery. His acceptance speech emphasized the intimate connection between race and poverty
that would only continue to grow. I am mindful that debilitating and grinding poverty afflicts my people and chains them to the lowest rung of the economic ladder, said King. He implicitly responded to Malcolm X's question. Why was he being given a peace prize in a time when domestic racial violence in the United States continued? The answer, he surmised, could be seen in the hope that swelled among people all over the world in the wake of Birmingham, a hope that continued in the face of the violent deaths of civil rights workers in Mississippi during Freedom Summer. I have the audacity, King explained, to believe that peoples everywhere can have 3 meals a day for their bodies, education and culture for their minds, and dignity, equality, and freedom for their spirits. This last sentence offered a blueprint for black citizenship that viewed racial and economic justice as intertwined objectives, something that King would come to consider the civil rights movement's most profound challenge and opportunity. Like Malcolm X, King's vocation as a political leader now encompassed nothing less than the fate of humanity. 2 days later, Malcolm spoke to the Harlem Domestic Peace Corps, a group sponsored by the Har-U Act, Harlem's federally supported anti-poverty program. The speech addressed themes of black beauty, Pan-African identity, and political self-determination that would shortly become the hallmark of black power politics. Malcolm's discussion of how the African image in the Western imagination inspired white revulsion and black self-hatred would be taken up by the black arts movement the following year. Historically, Malcolm said, American imagemakers denigrated Africa, changing course only after decolonization made the continent attractive to the nation's political and economic self-interest. All you have to do is go to the African continent, travel from one end of it to the other, and you'll find out that the American position and influence has only replaced those of former colonial powers. I think there are plenty of good people in America, Malcolm reasoned, but there are also plenty of bad people in America, who seem to hold all the power. The State Department was presenting Africans with a rosy and moving picture of civil rights, burnished by legal cases, legislative victories, and King's Nobel Prize. U.S. officials in Africa suggested that black Americans were on the way to the promised land of integration. Malcolm believed American leaders were taking premature victory laps. It is impossible to give out peace medals when the people who are oppressed don't have peace, he said, once again jabbing at King. He ended his talk to Harlem's future leaders by recalling the impact of the Second World War on racial justice. Without mentioning that he had spent the war years hustling in Harlem and Roxbury, Malcolm praised this era as one where global events inspired a more democratic country. He resisted advocating a strategy of either self-defense or nonviolence, preferring the flexibility to resist political oppression and violence based on circumstances. The OAAU motto, by any means necessary, proved to be more than a simple slogan. It acknowledged that combating racial oppression required moving beyond the confines of the political binaries that continued to mesmerize the press, even though they obscured the fact that most blacks occupied multiple political and intellectual identities and affiliations. On December 17, 1964, Malcolm sat in the massive audience of Harlem's 369th Regiment Armory, a place where he had spoken before as the Nation of Islam's young prince. Now, he listened to King speak in the wake of winning the Nobel. New York City embraced King as a favorite son that day. Malcolm's attendance was a deft act of diplomacy. The day before, during a lecture at Harvard University Law School, he had again criticized King without mentioning his name. I would refuse to follow a general, he explained to the 1,000 attendees in the school's Sanders Theater, who accepted a peace prize before the battle was won. When pressed on whom he was referring to, Malcolm demurred. I have no comment on my good friend Dr. King, he said. Malcolm was now reunited, for the last time, with his good friend, whom he heard speak for the first time since the March on Washington. Politicians, including New York Mayor Robert F. Wagner,
who as recently as July had distanced himself from King's call for civilian review of police, burst with public displays of pride following King's Nobel Prize. "I can think of none who has won a more lasting place in the moral epic of America," explained Wagner at a City Hall ceremony earlier in the day where King received the Medal of Honor, the city's highest distinction. The celebration continued at a cocktail party at the Waldorf Astoria with Vice President Hubert Humphrey. The global status of the Nobel Prize made King too important for officials to ignore. Although Malcolm criticized King for accepting a peace prize in a time of war, King was publicly supporting political self-determination for the Congo, an issue that Malcolm raised whenever he could, and calling for international sanctions against the apartheid regime in South Africa. Their political worlds and personal fates converged in a shared passion for global human rights. Harlem was, in many ways, Malcolm's political turf and organizational headquarters. But that night, the neighborhood cheered for King. Malcolm listened carefully as King basked in what he identified as a mountaintop moment that, however personally satisfying, required subsequent time in the valley to fulfill a political destiny that remained unwritten. Malcolm perked up when King spoke of the dearth of poverty in Scandinavia, images that contrasted with scenes of American economic misery that stretched from coast to coast. King's global travels paralleled Malcolm's exploits, but the Baptist preacher spoke to larger audiences than the Muslim minister. King's words that night in Harlem touched Malcolm. 4 days later, in a sprawling lecture, also held in Harlem, that criticized America's economic and political system, Malcolm focused some of his most important thoughts on King. "There's one thing that Martin Luther King mentioned at the Armory the other night, which I thought was significant," Malcolm said, in a rare public tribute to the Nobel Prize winner's political brilliance. He mentioned that while he was in some of those Scandinavian countries, he saw no poverty. There was no unemployment, no poverty. Everyone was getting education, everyone had decent housing. Decent whatever they needed to exist. "Why," asked Malcolm, "did King mention those countries on his list as different?" Malcolm suggested that the social democracies in Western Europe offered an alternative political and economic model for black folk seeking a way out of racial injustice and economic misery. "It was a failure of political will," explained Malcolm, "that caused the richest nation on earth to be racked by poverty, unemployment, and miserable living conditions." King's description of a social democratic political system capable of providing basic living standards for all of its citizens struck Malcolm's imagination. Africa, like the Scandinavian countries King lauded, was also pursuing collectivist economic strategies to end poverty, a vision that conformed to Malcolm's search for new methods to address economic and racial injustice. "What they are using to solve their problems in Africa and Asia is not capitalism," he reminded his audience. Malcolm had also recently met Fannie Lou Hamer, the SNCC organizer whose public testimony nearly upended the Democratic Convention. In his lecture in Harlem, he characterized Hamer's vicious beating at the hands of Mississippi authorities as the language of brutality. It was a language that blacks had yet to master, but one Malcolm recognized. Black liberation, in certain instances, required political violence. The program that night asked what Mississippi had to do with Harlem. Malcolm answered by blurring the regional distinctions that masked a national crisis. "It isn't actually Mississippi. It's America. America is Mississippi," he proclaimed. "There's no such thing as a Mason-Dixon line. It's America. There's no such thing as the South. It's America." After describing Hamer as one of America's foremost freedom fighters, he went further. "You don't have to be a man to fight for freedom. All you have to do is be an intelligent human being." Malcolm's words showcased a rhetorical evolution on gender politics that remained, like King's, unfinished in his lifetime. Despite coming of political age within the patriarchal structure of the NOI, Malcolm had begun to develop a more nuanced sense of the relationship between gender, race, and power. he recognized and relied on the strength of black women, perhaps most profoundly his older half-sister, Ella Mae Collins, who, after leaving the NOI in part because of the group's sexism, financed his first trip to Africa and helped him organize the OAAU. In his new organization, Malcolm hoped to abandon some of the sexist tendencies that thrived in the nation. He recruited black women, who were brilliant organizers and thinkers. He cultivated a cross-section of gifted black women artists and intellectuals, whom he maintained an active correspondence with, perhaps most notably Maya Angelou, who served as Malcolm's surrogate in Africa. He was mentored by Shirley Graham Du Bois, a towering figure among black radicals and whose political experience surpassed his own. Singer Abby Lincoln and writers Rosa Gee and Sarah Wright formed political friendships with Malcolm. During an interview near the end of December, Malcolm praised African and Middle Eastern nations that educated men and women, singling out Ghana and Egypt as two examples where the pursuit of gender equality produced a more valid society, a more progressive society. The intellectual curiosity he displayed his entire life now made him more willing to question how patriarchal conventions sapped enormous potential from the black community. But Malcolm's relationships with women remained a work in progress, and he was still unable to make the gendered oppression of women an integral part of his overall political analysis. The subject of Martin Luther King Jr.'s Nobel Prize remained on Malcolm's mind during his last interview of the year. Malcolm took pains to explain that his difference with King was one of tactics, arguing that black people shouldn't be willing to be nonviolent unless white people are going to be nonviolent. Malcolm claimed he received equal satisfaction from his efforts to raise black consciousness as King did from his Nobel Prize. And when they show that they're fed up with this slow pace, you know, that's my reward. He predicted a storm of racial violence in the new year, a prospect that no honorific bestowed on King would change. King himself is probably a good man, Malcolm admitted, but the danger is that white people use King. According to Malcolm, King's nonviolence protected the guilty as well as the innocent. His message lulled white society into believing myths about American democracy and racial progress that remained dangerously out of reach for ordinary blacks. Almost as if apologizing for the blunt nature of his criticism, Malcolm presented a brief elegy of his political career. Whatever I do, whatever I did, whatever I've said, was all done in sincerity, he explained. That's the way I want to be remembered, because that's the way it is. Malcolm spent the next several weeks primarily on the road, a roving political evangelist preaching a message of radical black dignity. In January, he met for hours with the writer Leroy Jones at the Waldorf Astoria, holding a political seminar that would soon transform black culture. Jones's restless intelligence fueled his brash literary work, including the Obie Award-winning play Dutchman, which chronicled the brutal death of a black man at the collective hands of white society. Several hours of conversation with Malcolm set Jones politically and intellectually ablaze, a fire that would culminate in a movement for black arts that identified Malcolm X, along with John Coltrane, as its political and cultural avatar. Over time, Malcolm was drawn deeper into the orbit of civil rights activism. SNCC proved to be a natural ally. He admired the group's political courage, even as he disapproved of their tactical adherence to nonviolence. In late December, he played host to a SNCC-sponsored delegation of 37 young people visiting from Macomb, Mississippi, at the Hotel Teresa. They listened to Malcolm express political solidarity with their efforts to bring racial justice to the Magnolia State. He told them that he would go for nonviolence only if everyone else did, including black people's political adversaries. There is some worse segregation right here in New York City than there is in Macomb, Mississippi, Malcolm said, disputing the notion that northern cities were somehow immune to Jim Crow. During the question and answer portion of the event, Malcolm summed up his feelings about black participation in democratic institutions. If you were born in this country, nobody's doing you any favor when they let you vote, when they let you register, he reminded them. They're only recognizing you as a human being and recognizing your right as a human being to exercise your right as a citizen. Malcolm's talk of human rights and disarmingly gentle demeanor could still surprise critics, interlocutors, and strangers expecting the firebrand whose reputation preceded him. On January 6, 1965, Malcolm rode a chartered bus to Albany, New York, as the guest of his lawyer and friend Percy Sutton, who was the recently elected assemblyman from Harlem. Malcolm came to watch Sutton take his seat at the start of the New York State Legislative Assembly and to witness anew the machinery of democracy. On the ride, Malcolm chatted amiably with a stunned white minister who had expected fire and brimstone, only to find himself engaged in a discussion about the environment and the pastoral scenes witnessed on the way to the state capitol. At the legislature, Malcolm sat in a front row gallery seat close to Republican Governor Nelson Rockefeller, his unexpected appearance startling reporters and alarming undercover state police. When asked what he thought of Rockefeller's address, Malcolm dropped one of his classic lines. "The message was quite long," he observed, "but the part on civil rights was too short." Malcolm spent the rest of January giving lectures, conducting interviews, and engaging in correspondence designed to consolidate the international inroads the OAAU had achieved through his extensive travels. His planned itinerary barely stayed ahead of continuing efforts by Muslims connected to the NOI to assassinate him. Just after 11 p.m. on January 22nd, a group of would-be assassins stepped toward him as he opened the door to leave his home, an attack thwarted only by their mistimed approach, which caused them to retreat. Malcolm often traveled with bodyguards and carried a tear gas pen for protection, but he knew in his bones that this would offer no defense against Muslims bent on killing him as an apostate. Martin Luther King Jr. emerged from the endless rounds of Nobel Prize celebrations in Selma, Alabama, which the SCLC planned to use as its headquarters for a voting rights campaign. The action in Selma followed the strategic recipe utilized in Birmingham, with the ultimate goal being voting rights rather than the desegregation. Throughout the month of January, King and his aides organized peaceful demonstrations where groups of blacks tried to legally register at the Selma courthouse, only to be arrested by the officers of Sheriff Jim Clark, a racist caricature who wore a button emblazoned "Never" as a response to the prospect of racial integration. "We must be willing to go to jail by the thousands," King told followers. He led by example, getting arrested on February 1st at the Selma courthouse alongside almost 800 demonstrators. In jail, King almost received a most unexpected visitor. On Wednesday, February 3rd, Malcolm spoke to 3,000 students at Tuskegee University. The crowd's overwhelming size forced organizers to close the doors 10 minutes before the start of his 8 p.m. lecture. Malcolm then drove to Selma's Brown Chapel AME Church the next day in a small red sports car. His unmistakable presence raised temperatures among King's staff until the SCLC decided to co-sponsor his appearance. Organizer Andy Young, who enjoyed a friendly relationship with Malcolm, slotted him between James Bevel and Coretta Scott King to inoculate the impressionable from the siren song of self-defense. They needn't have bothered. Malcolm spoke for an hour in support of black voting rights in Selma, which he described as the heart of a national struggle for black citizenship, whose true contours, he insisted, were global. Sitting on the dais next to Coretta, Malcolm relayed a message that caught her off guard.
"Mrs. King, will you tell Dr. King that I'm sorry I won't get to see him? I had planned to visit him in jail, but I have to leave," Malcolm explained. "I want him to know that I didn't come to make his job more difficult. I thought that if the white people understood what the alternative was, they would be willing to listen to Dr. King." Malcolm's performance in Selma reaffirmed Coretta Scott King's private regard for him, one that she recalled her husband shared. After hearing reports of Malcolm's exemplary behavior in Selma, King made quiet plans to reach out to him after the conclusion of the voting rights efforts in Alabama. Over the next 2 weeks,
Malcolm continued to sketch out how black political self-determination might possibly avert a more violent revolution. Indignities and death threats parallel these efforts. French authorities banned his February 9th appearance, barring him from a country he had spoken in less than 3 months before. After failing to get through customs, Malcolm boarded a flight back to London, stunned at what he considered a personal affront to his status as a radical international statesman. French officials had determined Malcolm's presence in Paris to be needlessly inflammatory. His words of fire about African decolonization mirrored the rebellious stirrings of a variety of Third World and Caribbean immigrants residing in France. 2 days later, during a speech at the London School of Economics, Malcolm sought to redefine America's domestic civil rights struggle as an international human rights movement. He spoke passionately about the consequences of racial demonization of black people in America, which enabled the creation of a police state system that made it permissible in the minds of even the well-meaning white public for law enforcement to brutally suppress political dissent and personal dignity. They used the press to set up this police state, Malcolm argued, and they used the press to make the white people accept whatever they do to the dark-skinned public. The logic of this kind of racial injustice stretched across the Atlantic, observed Malcolm. They do that here in London right now with the constant